1965, and we have, and I am Irving Reed, and we have as a speaker Mr. Oliver Morris. Mr. Morris, will you give your full name and your present address?
My full name, Oliver D. Morris, and my present address is Sprucewood Road, Fairbanks, Alaska.
And where and when were you born now?
I was born in 1894 in Seattle, Washington.
And what were the names of your parents and what business were they in?
My father was Will H. Morris, and he was attorney in Seattle, prosecuting attorney in the early days in Seattle.
Are you married, Mr. Morris?
Yes, I'm married.
And do you have any children? I know you do.
I have three children, two daughters and one boy.
And now what business are you in now?
Well, I'm retired now.
What are your hobbies, are you particularly?
Well, monkeying around, making little sleds and different things. Working around the house.
What made you decide to come to Alaska?
Well, that's in the early days, Nome. Seems like my folks, about everyone that go north, had stopped at the house. And they had a very dear friend there, Jaffe Lindeberg, and he always used to come at the house there. And I was pretty young. And when he had come back from Nome in the fall, he'd stop at the house again. He'd either give me $5, $10, or $20 gold piece. So that got me interested. And these people going up and coming back, some made it, some didn't.
When did you come to Alaska, Mr. Morris?
1914.
I used to know Jaffe. Well, will you would you like to tell us now your story when you came here and what happened?
I came to Teller, Alaska.
On what boat?
On the Victoria. Johnny O'Brien was skipper of it. And my brother-in-law mined at Teller there, Sullivan. And he mined 2 years there and went broke, and that finished their mining.
For what creek were you on there?
American Creek.
On American Creek, yeah, I've been there.
Yes. So, after that, I didn't come north then until 1920. I was down in Eacock, Alaska, during fishing there for Libby McNeil and Libby. Then in 22, I went a little further north and finally landed up in Carnation Gulf Country, Northwest Territory. And at that time, White Fox was going up all the time, and an uneducated person, could make a pretty good stake. So my wife and I tried that for a good many years. And we made a little money, and when the fur went down, well, we still hung on. Then we moved over on the Alaska side, and I put in a post at Barrow, one at Cape Halkett, one at Barter Isle, and one at Demarcation. And the fur wasn't so good. No matter how many fur you had, you didn't have very much. And the market went up a little bit, and go down a little bit and keep making a few dollars. Some years you didn't make anything. And that's the way it went.
Well, what kind of a life did you leave? And did you have a post in Coronation Gulf? Or?
Yes, we had. We left Herschel Island. We had a little schooner. Pulled about 17 tons, and we had trade stuff for the Kogmollock Eskimo. And we had 5 sacks of coal that was supposed to do us for part of the winter, and then gather up some driftwood in there. But we got in there, we'd use 4 sacks going in, 1,000 miles east of Herschel Island. And we gathered up what wood we could, and January the 1st, well, it was pretty nip and tuck in there. So we were burning nigger heads and blubber and bones and everything else to keep warm.
Where'd you depart from?
Herschel Island.
You started from Herschel Island. Go to Coronation Gulf?
Yeah, that was, we went 1,000 miles east in...
Copper Mine?
East of the Copper Mine.
East of the Copper Mine.
Kugarik River it was.
Kugarik. It's those names we want as you go along with your story.
Yeah.
What were the Eskimos in there then?
Yeah, they were the long-haired Eskimos. The men and the boys wore the hair down to their hips.
Down to their hips?
They were all long-haired people.
Tell us about it.
And they had, their dress was kind of a swallowtail, like a swallowtail evening dress. And when we were in there, we had quite a few killings amongst their own people. And also, there was a couple of white people killed there. Police boy, Hudson Bay Factor man. But after you understood the people, you could understand why the killings were committed. And until you did, you didn't know why, but we understood the people very well. And we had, quite a few of them, our best friends, they were murderers. Got along very nicely with them. We had... We had this Looksook and Senesiak, you know, to kill the priests. They were one of our best friends there. It was... and then we had... the boys that killed the Hudson Bay Factor man and the police boy, of course, they hung those boys at Herschel Island. But they were trying to make them do women's work, and that's what started the killing there. You see, the boy, that was women's work, and he didn't want to do it. He wanted to go out to sealing camp, and the police wouldn't let him.
This is over on the Canadian side. Then.
This is on the, yeah, on the Canadian side, Northwest Territory, in the Arctic.
Mm-hmm. Did those people live in snow houses in the wintertime?
Yes, they're nomadic people. They travel, and in the wintertime they build their snow houses on the ice or on the points of land. That's usually where it's good sealing in the winter through the ice. And they'll all gather at this point so they can cover all these holes, these blow holes, so they get a good kill. And it takes quite a lot of people to cover the holes. And if they don't have enough people, well, of course, they'll have a pretty hard time.
Well, are their clothing entirely in seal, or do they get...
No, the caribou migrate through the country. Oh, sometimes they'll come through there, 500,000 or a million, and they get them as they come through. Sometimes they'll have to go quite a ways for them, other times very short distance.
The caribou go right across Coronation Gulf.
Yeah, they come down from North Canadian Islands, and they're a small caribou compared to, they're the barren land caribou. The further north you go, the smaller the caribou. And those caribou go way up into the 80s. And they come down, and that herd there comes down about Coronation Gulf and then goes back up. But then there's a bunch on the mainland goes back through the barren land country. And you'll get some of those down here, what we call the Canada-Alaska herd, that cut down through the First River country, back of Herschel Island, and come down the American side and then drop over on the Crow Flat country and come down here to Eagle and back in the Northwest Territory. Takes them about 12 months to make that cycle, and they've been making it for a good many years. And,
you were interested in fur. Were you getting this fur by trade goods or cash?
No, it's all barter.
All barter?
Yes, barter. I trapped, my wife did the trading. So we had, at that time we had the Hudson Bay people, they were fighting the free traders. So when you put in a place, we used to operate out of the schooner for the warehouse, and the Hudson Bay next year would come in and put a place right alongside of you. And then we'd move, and about a year later, they'd put another place alongside you. But finally, it got a little too tough for them. They couldn't break the free trader, so they gave it up eventually. But they tried to give you a bad time. But it was pretty hard because their operating expense was enormous compared to a free trader. He had practically no expense. So finally they did away with that system. They're very nice. They treated us very nice. Man, latter years that was, of course.
Did you ever know Joe Bernard up there?
Yes, I knew Joe and I knew Pete. Yes.
Ira Rank?
Ira Rank. Yes, I knew all the old timers. Yes, we were the youngest up there. When we went in the country, all old timers, old whalers, a lot of them had been paid off after their cruise of 3 or 4 years and remained in the country on the American side and also on the Canadian side. And that was, practically the whole population of the country was old whalers, mostly American. Boy, there were very few Canadians or English in Canada. In the Arctic at that time, it was all American. They had the Hudson Bay people in there and the Royal Canadian Mounted Police in there. But all of them were Americans in that country.
This period was between what dates, what years that you speak of now, 1920?
This was 1924 when we went in the Canadian Arctic country.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned those long-haired natives. Now, was that confined to Herschel Island?
No, that was east of Herschel Island. That's all through 1,000 miles east there. That took in, we called it Victoria Land at that time. They call it Victoria Island now. And Banks Land, they call that Banks Island. King William's Land, all in that country. Boothia Peninsula, Queen Maud Sea, Kent Peninsula, Bathurst, that was all the long-haired people as you dropped in on the Greenland side.
Were they truly Eskimos?
Yes, they were Eskimos.
Mm-hmm. Did you ever see them?
Stephenson called them the blonde Eskimo. Their skin was white, but their hands and face was tan.
Were they light-eyed, any of them?
There was, I knew two that were... one was named Kaiwina, and she was about 90. She was blue-eyed, and she had lived at King William's Land when she was a little girl. And she told us when she was a little girl about the Franklin expedition that she remembers them crossing the northwest part of King William's Land to Queen Maud Sea to get across in the ice there. And they were dying along the way, dragging one boat behind them, and a great big lifeboat off a whaling ship. And I think there was 5 bodies found in that boat in latter years, skulls of them, and that's as far as they got. They didn't have the proper dress, the foot gear, the feet went out first, you know, and then the hands.
Were they long-haired,
Eskimo,
black hair?
Yeah, they're all black-haired people. Mm-hmm. But Stephenson, in his friendly Arctic, he called them the blonde Eskimo, but there wasn't any blondes. The only one that had any blondes was Charlie Klickenberg in there. He had one girl, I believe, was blonde, but he had married Point Hope Eskimo in the early days, around 1880-something. And took her in that country.
Mm-hmm. When did you move over to Alaska?
We came out Alaska in 1931 on the Alaska side.
see any muskoxen in that country?
Yes, there's muskox detention harbor that was south of us about 100 miles. We'd moved out on a little island they called, Eskimos called Etipik Island. It was off Victoria Land, and south of us there was a big herd, detention harbor, and of course north of us on the north slope of Victoria Land, lots of muskox, and lots of muskox on the north slope of Banks Island. And north of there on Melville Island, that's all muskox country in there. All through the North Islands. There's big herds.
Were you concentrating on any particular animal when you were doing your tapping?
Yeah, it's a white fox country. Mm-hmm. It's an ice fox.
Mm-hmm. Are there many other types of animals? Were there many other types of animals taken at that time?
Well, no. Of course, you had wolves and wolverine, and you had your polar bear.
Is it still the same today? Are they still?
I imagine so. It's a large country, and of course, nowadays the plain has made it a very small country because they have fields all through the country. They have fields on Melville Island north. That's about 76 north. And, of course, on Ellesmere Land, they have fields there across from Greenland, King William's Land, all through the country. The dew line has circled the North American continent. So you have fields the whole, circling the whole country there.
You went east from Herschel Island into Coronation Gulf with a boat. When you spent the winters in there, did you live on the boat or beach the boat?
Oh, no. No, we had a few boards of shiplap and about 16, 18 too before. And we'd go ashore and build our place. Put the sheets of the schooner over it, and then when the snow came, we'd snowblock the shack over to keep the wind away from it. And that was your home.
And what did you do with your boat?
Well, we pulled her out.
Pulled her out?
Yes.
When you put this on the shore, you didn't live on the ice like the Eskimos, huh? You didn't have your house on the ice, or did you?
Oh, no.
You put
no.
it on the shore?
Yes. No, the Eskimos, they would build when they go to sealing camp. If they could build on a point where the bank, where it dripped over the snow, was easy building the house, cut your snow block. But in the spring, sometimes where it drifts on the ice, they'd build there when they're going to seal. But we usually built close to a bank where you had a depth of snow to cover your house, you see, so it wouldn't be so hard. And it's a different kind of snow than you have down here. It's the wind makes it a hard snow. It's like more like cutting sod blocks. Oh, you can cut them right out with a snow knife or a saw and start building.
What did you use for fuel after you got there?
Well, our first winter in there, we had it pretty rough. I killed a few seal in the fall, and we used the blubber. And our nigger heads, we'd cut the nigger heads, and we'd burn that with blubber, and also bones. Cut the bones up and burn that. That'd hold the fire pretty good, the bones, because it has lots of oil in it. But the first winter we had it pretty tough. The next year I got from the Hudson Bay, we had a manager in there by the name of Herodi that he'd sell me. He was at Bernard Harbor, that was west of us. And he would sell me all the coal I wanted, but I had to sell him the fox, my fox. Well, I wouldn't do that. So that year when the Bay Chimo came in, we had the whole manager for the Eastern Arctic and Western Arctic by the name of Smith. He came in, and I went aboard the ship, the Bay Chimo, and told him about it. And he says, Mr. Morris, he says, you can have the coal and you don't have to sell us your fur. So the outcome of it was he transferred this Western District manager up the Mackenzie River on account of this steel. This is a forest steel. So I bought a ton and a half of coal from them. We figured that would be enough for us to get by the winter, which it was. And the price was in that far was $360 a ton. That was reasonable because it was that was 5,000 miles from Vancouver into where we were. So that was very reasonable. But that first year, I'd made a trip about 125 miles over to Clickenberg there at Reimer Point on Victoria Land, and he sold me two sacks of coal for $70 a sack. So that's all he'd sell me, though. I was glad to get.
What was your trip with, dogs?
Yes, we had dogs. We always had, eventually we got it up to 20, 24 dogs. I had two females, so we had pups every year.
Did you go on your buying trips with dogs?
Yes, in those days you could sled in that country and trade on your sled, you see. So I used to hit these people, and they come out from the barren land country, and I'd have ammunition, whatever they wanted, tobacco, tea, sugar, and calico on the sled. And I would trade from the sled. But two or three years later, the Hudson Bay people, they run the country, and they had a law passed where you couldn't trade from the sled. You had to have a post to trade from. So, but then they would come to our place and trade. We seemed to get a little more fur than the Hudson Bay did. They had three places close to us and about 200 miles. And it seems like we had most of the fur, and they didn't.
Tell us about some of the interesting native characters that came into trade.
Well, we had one that came in. He came in, come down from the barren land country, and he was the only one that really bad. He came out and he said he had killed three Indians inland. And so I reported to Sergeant Baker next summer when we went into Bernard Harbor with our schooner and told him about it. So he said, well, he had run across them. This native was going to the copper mine for the summer to fish there and be there in the fall, and Sergeant Baker would go down and ask him about this killing. So he went down there, but this native had seen that after, looks like Sinisiak had been out to the penitentiary when they killed the priest, they'd come back and told him what a nice country it was out there. They were at Regina, that this boy wanted a trip out, so that was the only way he'd get a trip out, you see. So there wasn't, Sergeant Baker figured there wasn't anything to it. But that's why he made that story, that he would like to have the trip out.
What kind of fishing do they get up there on the Coppermine River?
Well, the Coppermine River, they catch the char fish is similar to the salmon, and it's, they'll go from 4 to 37, 38 pounds. It's a nice fish. In the fall of the year, they're very nice and fat. I used to fish there in the fall. I'd go down with a schooner, and I'd go up to what they call Bloody Falls up the river. That was about 12 miles up the river. And then I'd put my nets out, and I'd catch 12, 13, 14 tons of fish just before freeze-up, and that was our dog feed for the winter, take it home. Throw it down the hatch of the schooner. It would remain half frozen until I'd get home, and I'd make a cache for it, put it in the cache so the animals couldn't get to it.
Did those Eskimos use kayaks and umiaks like the other?
Well, yes, they make a very narrow kayak compared to the Alaska side. The Alaska's very wide, and these kayaks, the Kogmalik people, are very narrow.
I don't know how they could go in them And, the Alaskan ones are hard enough.
Yeah, but these are awful tricky. Alaskan ones aren't bad, but those cosmolic makers, very, very narrow. And, well, when Rasmussen came through, he had a couple made for him. He brought them out from when he made that trip from Greenland through the Northwest country up there.
Tell me, what kind of hitch do they have the dogs there? Do you hitch them like the Greenland style, or the...
The gnome style.
Gnome style.
Yeah, we used always the gnome style. The Cogmolic people used the Greenland style, the fan shape.
Mm-hmm.
The reason they use that, because you're traveling ice and it doesn't stop your team, because your lines are pyramided, the long ones for your leader, and it doesn't stop your team when they want to relieve themselves. That's why the Cogmolic people use that.
Do they have those solid runner sleds now?
No, they use, in the wintertime, they use a mud runner sled in that country.
Which?
A mud runner.
Oh, yes.
They take the dirt with the, that has hundreds of little fibers in it, like thread, and you bring that in the house and in the fall and pull it apart and knead it like dough. Make kind of a putty form out of it. Maybe you'd bring in 150, 200 pounds of it and get it all nice and work shape. And then in the cold weather, you go out and you start putting this on your runner. You shape it the form of an egg over your runner. And then you, when you get all that mud on, then you take and rasp it down, take all the high bumps off. But then you take a bear skin or bear skin preferred, because you have oil in the hair of a polar bear. You see, on a caribou, there's no oil. And you take and run that down with water, with very light coating of water over your runner, and then you're ready for business. And when you start out in the morning, you give it another very light coat up and down. And that'll do you a half a day before you have to ice your runners up again.
That is better than iron.
Oh, well, iron you can't use in the winter, because your cold weather, your iron sticks right to the snow. Your dogs couldn't break it, couldn't pull it. Used to use iron bark runners and hickory runners, but mud runners are the best. I tried it on the Alaska side when we moved over on the Alaska side, mud runners. I tried it 1 year, but you have so much sand east of Point Barrow, the islands, you know, and the wind that blows the sand over the snow. Well, the sand on ice runners eats your ice right off. So I had to give that up. The next year I used iron bark and hickory runners in the wintertime.
We used to use iron bark and hickory
and
gnome, too.
Yes.
Did you use mucklucks for your dogs?
In the spring, on tripping, I'd use, I'd make 400 or 500, 600 canvas mucklucks for them, 8 ounce.
Flank protectors?
Well, belly bands. Mm-hmm. Some dogs I'd use belly bands with a piece of caribou hide around the flank. If you're heading into wind, some dogs would freeze the flanks easy, others wouldn't. Of course, if you froze a flank in a dog, that laid him up for that winter, so you were out of dog. But in the spring, I always shooed my dog. Sometimes I made 600-700 mile trip in the spring, and I'd start out maybe with 600 shoes. A shoe would last a half a day, and that ice would be melting, and it'd be kind of needly ice some places, and cut the dog's feet without the protection. And then half a day I'd reshoe them again. So I tried to keep their feet in good shape until we got home, because you had the overflow of water that time of year. That'd be in May. Up until the first part of June, the overflow would come on the sea ice, you see, and make your ice all wet.
Now, take us on a sled trip. You're starting out now. Load the sled for us. Tell us what you took. You're stopping tonight. Tell us how you build your camp and how you sleep and how you get up in the morning and go on and how you feed your dogs.
Well, in the fall, November, our trapping season started in there in November the 15th. So I'd leave the house on maybe the 12th or 13th of November with so much dog feed, beef fish, blubber on the sled, my own grub, two primer stoves, a gallon of kerosene, my grub box, snow knife, saw, shovel, and then I would start out, and my first camp I'd build out of snow box. I'd go on a half a day and set my traps, then I'd go on a half a day without setting traps when I figured it was a day's travel, and then I'd start building. I'd build my house that night, and next morning I'd break camp again and go on, set traps a half a day, go on and half a day without setting and build again till I had 11 camps out. Some places I'd go 15 miles before I'd build, some places 20 miles, some places 25 miles, all depend on the location of the formation of the land. Some breaks in the land were, especially in the islands, where I'd go 10 miles and I wouldn't have a set. Other places on the Big Island, I'd maybe have 40 sets in 3 or 4 miles. Some places I wouldn't have a set for 5 miles. All depend on the break of the land, where you figured the fox would travel, come off of the land, or a prominent point, or a gully, or something like that. And when all my camps were out, then when I came back, then I'd fill in the traps that I'd missed a half day. In fact, I set all winter long until trapping season stopped, and then I'd start pulling. But I used over 700 traps, of course, during the winter. Some places I would cut out for 20 or 30 miles. I'd leave those, you see. But I would have, I'd say, around 500 traps working all year. But I'd have about 700 working right at the start as soon as I could get them out. I used to run east and west 180 miles, east and west. That was 360 miles a round trip. And I tried to make that twice a month.
It intrigues me. You said you took how much fuel? A gallon of kerosene for your primer stove?
Yeah, I always carried...
And that lasted you how long?
Well, halfway on my trap line in the summer, I would go over, and halfway camp, I'd make a cache of flour, sugar, and coal oil halfway, so I wouldn't have to carry that in the fall, you see. And my traps, I'd have this halfway camp, so I wouldn't have to haul from the house. But on the sled, I always carried two primer stoves and a gallon of kerosene, emergency rations, tea, and oatmeal. So when you got caught, before hitting the camp, you were all right, because you got caught many times, you'd have to build on account of your northeasters and southwesters in there. I think that's where the wind originates from, and she blows. She blows pretty hard sometimes.
Tell us about, you're in a bad blow and you're going to build right now. Now, these people have never seen one built. They have no conception of what size it is and so forth. Take us through a description of building a camp this evening. The wind is blowing hard and you're going to stop right now and build a shelter.
Well, when you can't see anymore, you know your camp's close by, but you can't find it. You're not lost. The camp's lost. You're all right.
I've been that way several times.
You know where you are, but you can't find the place. You'll either be just a quarter of a mile to it, or 200 feet from it, but you can't locate it. Your dogs can't locate it. Well, then you build. You take your snow knife and you stick down these drifts. If there's no ice in the snow where you stick your knife, if it don't stick, if you can hit the ice in there, it's no good, because when you cut a snow block, it'll crumble on you. Well, you want to get a drift where your snow will be 3 or 4 feet thick if you can.
What length of blade are you talking about in a snow knife?
Well, we use a 14-inch blade to make a handle, a very thin handle with wood, come out about 3 or 4 inches. So when you cut your block, you cut your block 2 feet, 2.5 feet long, and 1 foot wide, and about 1 foot deep. So when you cut your block, you cut on both sides with your knife, then the back, you cut a string down, then you make about 3 hits, one this way, one this way, and one this way, and then you come back with your snow knife and pull out like that, and your block should come loose. If it doesn't come loose, you take your knife in the front of the block underneath and the knife there and loosen it up that way, and finally give it a hit for the hand and come loose, and then you take it and put it in your arm this way, the heavy part of the block there, and where the butt's on here, there's no knife in this hand. You carry that and to where you're going to build. You're going to build right there, and you set your block down. You always build a snow house. You start from your king block. You build around right, not left, you see. Right's the way. Maybe if you were left-handed, you would go left. But right is most of the way. You go around right. You take your block this way and set it down on your other block where you're building, and your knife's on your right hand side, and you just take your knife like that to set the block on the other block, and then you take this hand, hit it like that, and that sets it, and you go to another block until finally you've got all your blocks around. Well, your last, and by this time your snow house is coming in, you see, you come in a little bit. Well, the last, and when you get right at the top, it's about, you'll have a space about 3 blocks. Well, you leave inside of the house the snow. You don't disturb that snow inside, you see. So you use that snow inside. You go in after you get it that far along, then you go inside and cut these blocks to form the ceiling, the top piece. Takes just about 3, then you cut those and shove them up this way and set them in that way. And then get that in, then you chink up all inside. That's for a night stop.
What's our inside diameter and height for a night stop?
Night stop would be about 6 feet, 6.5 feet high. Mm-hmm. And the diameter would be, I'd say 8 feet.
8 feet
in diameter.
How long would that take?
45 minutes.
And your door is conventional?
No, your door, you...
pull a block in.
When you build, you don't leave a door, but your king block, you have a king block on each side where you're going to have the door. Your king block is upright. It's a big block. But you fill that in with blocks. So when you come to open, cut your door, then you take your snow knife and cut your door there. But you only cut a small door like this. Be about this wide, just enough so you can get in your grub box in. Then you take that snow block out that you've cut for a door and you put that inside the snow house. So when you go to bed at night, you take that block and put it at the door. Close your door. See, in the morning, all you do is take your snow knife around like that, and your door is open. And that
you
keeps
an opening somewhere, or you close it up?
No, you keep a vent open. Yes. Yes, you have to have a vent in the snow house. You don't, if you use open the primer stove, it'll knock you over. The fumes, you know, you have to have a vent.
What size does this vent hold?
Oh, it can be, just take your snow knife and run it through there and wiggle it around. That's a vent. Stephenson found that out. He did that. That country he had a native with him. They didn't put a vent in, and they dragged Steph out with the, by his feet, almost killed him. I was talking to the native there that was with Stephenson at that time.
How do you kill them boys?
Well, that one back there, he was born in Barrow. And then one girl was born 1,500 miles east-northeast of Point Barrow. And the first girl, my wife went outside to have because she was getting along in years. And so I sent her out on the Bay Chima to Vancouver. And then she went to Seattle and had the baby in Seattle. And next spring, she brought the baby down the Mackenzie River. And she was 3 months on the trip before I picked her up. She had the young baby. That's this girl we have here. She's married to George Huffrit. That's the oldest girl.
Do you take the other girl born?
The other girl? She was born in Coronation Gulf, in Tiptic Island. I was the midwife for that one.
When you were trading? Or in your travels, did you ever come across a group of people that you never seen a white man before?
No. No, I never had. That's an old country in there. The early English, from way back in the 1600s, maybe before that 1500s, explored all through that country. An awful lot of that country. So they've been in contact with white people for a good many hundreds of years. Yes.
Did you leave your dogs right out in the weather when you camped? Or?
Oh, yes. Toggled them down.
Toggled them down.
Yes, and they'd drift over, you know. No, those dogs, if you'd build a place for them, they wouldn't go in it. Yeah.
Did they ever use a loose leader?
I have used a loose leader, yeah. I've used 2 leaders, and I've used one female. I used to use her loose once in a while. She had run ahead of the dogs sometimes get 200 feet ahead. And she would she'd answer my command either way, loose.
The advantage of a loose leader?
There's no advantage, I don't think. I used 2. I had one that was good at night travel, and I had another one that was good at day travel. Some at night travel are not so good, and others are. So this one I used double leader. The one that wasn't good at night, it would lead the other one lead at night. Well, in 1922, they started to go up, and they went to 29. They went to $70 a bale. That's $7,000 for 100 skins. That was unsight and unseen. That's culls, 3s, 2s, and 1s, you see.
Can you tell us what...
That was the tops.
Can you describe setting a fox set?
The barren land ice set, yes. It's you take and get a prominent place where you have to, in that country, your prevailing winds are northeast and southwest. And you make a set so it won't drift over on the prevailing winds, that set will keep clear. The snow will drift over instead of build up and foul it up, you see. Then you take, and some sets you've got to build up with snow and tramp it down. Other sets, if you get an ice set where it's pretty flat, natural set, you take an axe and cut a hole for your trap, put your trap in there. Then you take a snow block. You have to have a kind of a pulverized snow. It's kind of like rock candy, but very fine. And you take a block of snow like that and shape it, the shape of your trap, and you cut it down about 4 inches. Then you take and put that over your trap, and then take your snow knife and you whittle the snow down until you can just very faintly see the shadow of the tongue of the trap. Then you know that's thin enough. Then you take and chink up all along the side so you don't leave any holes there for the wind to cut underneath and cut your plate off or fill it full of snow so you can put your trap out of shape. So if you don't get the proper snow, your trap, the wind come along and liable to eat your plate off and put your trap out of shape. But your trap should say, if they're set properly with the right snow, they should last two or three weeks, some a month, before they'll freeze down and be out of order.
Were all your set steel traps, or did you use dead balls or anything along?
No, we used all steel traps. We used ones and a half, number two traps.
Now, how did you anchor this trap, and how did you mark it so you found it when you came back?
Well, you anchor your trap, you can take a little toggle, a piece of wood. You start out with a little piece of wood and wrap your ring around that trap and put it down the snow and tramp on it, and that sets in just a few minutes. You'll have to dig it out yourself. Nothing will pull that out. And what was the other one you asked me now?
The fine.
How do you mark it when you got 700 of them strung?
Well, you know, it's when you come to a camp, you say, well, I've got a trap there, I got a trap here, I got a trap there. You're setting on all prominent places, you see, as a rule. Some places you don't. But if you miss one, your leader will find it because he knows. He knows where you set the year before. A good leader, you'll say, well, we set here last year, and he'll stop there. Sometimes, one set, I had a set of four, was in a bay, and back in there, and the next trip over, instead of going back in there, I cut across to save time. And he wanted to go in there, and I wouldn't let him. About the third trip, I said, well, we must have something in there, so I went back in there. He was right, I had a set of four in there, see, and there's two foxes in them.
What do you use for baiting the trap?
Well, in the winter time, I use blubber. I'd take a hunk of blubber, about an inch square and about 4 inches long, 5 inches long, and I'd put that back of my trap, a foot back, and dig it, take my snow knife and dig it down, put about 2 inches down the snow, tramp it in. Then behind that, I'd take a snow block. Put the snow block there about 10 inches high and put a small snow block on each side so he couldn't come back here and eat. He'd have to come around the front or the side to eat it. When he did that, he'd step in the trap. You'd either catch him with the front foot or back foot. Sometimes you'd catch him with the tail, once in a while with the nose. But sometimes you'd put a double set. You'd put on the same toggle, you'd put two traps. You'd have one trap here, one trap there, you see. That'd be a double set. So if the fox had come up here this way and spring that set without getting caught, he'd move over and this set here would catch him. But a double set takes a little longer time, and you don't want a double set if you can get away from it, because that takes a few minutes, and a few minutes is quite a long time.
What did you consider a good time on a set, for setting up a set?
Making a set?
Yeah.
Sometimes 10 minutes, sometimes 15, 20 minutes if you had to build up. A natural set may be only 3 or 4 minutes, you see.
Well, could you take all the traps at one load?
Oh, no. Did no, the traps, out? No, I cached halfway, you see. In the summer. Oh no, it's too heavy.
Was there ever the possibility that you were forced to camp someplace where you couldn't build a snow house?
Oh no.
Always snow?
No, there's always snow. Yes, always snow.
You said something about using oil for fuel. How did you do that?
Coal oil.
Coal oil?
Oh yes.
Natural laying on the ground?
Oh no, we ship in from Vancouver.
Yes. He's thinking of the oil at Cape Simpson.
Oh, yes, when we were on the American side. Oh, yes, we burnt that from Cape Simpson. Yes, we burnt that for years. That was our fuel.
It saturated the muskeg and made kind of a peat, or was it just the oil itself?
It's from the creek there. That creek, I don't know, I stuck a pole down 17 feet, splice pole, and I didn't hit any bottom. We used the overflow from the creek that went back in the tundra, like a putty form.
Oh.
Yeah, but the heart of the creek you couldn't use because it was pure crude oil, and you'd sack it in the summertime, you'd haul the beach and all run out during the heat, you see, so you wouldn't get home on it. So we'd use what came off the creek that went into the tundra, and the sun had dried the oil out of it, extracted the oil from it.
For you people that don't know, here is Herschel Island, and here is Coronation Gulf, and this is the route he's talking about trading on.
Mr. Morris, I wonder if you'd back up again. You were referring to that fictional killing and the reference to Indians. Now, were there Indians?
Well, they had had, that was before our time in there, the Bloody Falls on the copper mine is named after the big Indian War and the Eskimos there, but that was long before we were in the country. Because the Indians would come out through the barren lands and they kept further north. The Eskimos would go back in there for the caribou skins for their clothes in the summer, you see. Their late July skins for summer, for skin clothes. And they'd meet the Indians there, and they never got along, you know. Had the wars and quite a few killings, but while we were there they didn't. That was many years before our time.
Eskimos and Indians don't like each other.
No, the Alaska and the Arctic, on the Alaska side, you take your Barrow Eskimos, your Wainwright Eskimos, Point Lay Eskimos, they're scared to death to this day of Indians there, you know.
Light your cigarette and make yourself to home. Mm-hmm. And then we would like to hear your description of your clothing that you wore out on the trail, from your foot gear to your head gear.
Well, I dressed like an Eskimo, like the Kognolik people. I had those people make my own, my clothes. I had inside fur pants. They were made from yearling with the hair next to your body. Inside parky with the hair next to your body, outside parky with the hair out, outside fur pants with the hair out, inside fur socks with the hair in.
Rabbit?
No. Caribou. And your boots, of course, with the deer leg boot, the caribou leg boot with the hair out. And the different kind of boots for your winter time, you had early fall boot, you had a late fall boot, you had a dead of winter boot, and a spring boot, you see. If you had those, you were properly dressed, and the elements couldn't hurt you.
What was the difference between those boots?
Well, the boots, your summer boot was a deerskin boot with the hair rotted off, with a ugra bottom. And your fall boot was could have been caribou legs with the hair in, and legs oiled with ugra bottom. And your late fall boot was usually with the hair out with ugra bottom. And your dead of winter boot was from the neck of the caribou bull, was supposed to have been the toughest if you could get it. That was the bottom with the hair in for your dead of winter boot. So if you had those, you were, the elements couldn't hurt you at all. Might have hurt your dogs, but it couldn't hurt you because you were dressed for it. But if you wasn't dressed for it, it'd hurt you.
If you say the summer boot was made out of deer, did I misunderstand you? Just like you said, deer skin.
The summer boot was out of seal skin.
Oh, pardon me, that's what,
yeah,
I asked.
The top's out of seal skin. You know, you could make it out of deer legs and oil it. with the hair in, you see. Oil the skin. The hair would be in, and the hide would be outside, but you'd have to oil it to make it waterproof, you see. That is, rub seal oil on it, or boil seal oil and put on it to make
and
it waterproof.
And all four of your grass were caribou?
Yes, all caribou. Mm-hmm.
Didn't use any polar bear like the Greenlanders did?
No, polar bear's awful heavy. Mm-hmm. Yeah, they don't...
They make their pants out of it.
They make their pants. If they get a yearling, or cubs, but the cub has to be 8 or 9 months of age. You take the young cubs, it's too tender. But they make anything under a year, makes nice pants. But anything over that is too heavy.
Do you have an inner sock, caribou sock inside the winter boot?
Well, you have your fur socks with the hair in.
Yeah.
Yes. Yes, I have home. I have quite a lot of the winter clothes. But every year I would have a new suit made. It'd take quite a few skins. And I'd use my fall, what I use that winter, I would use that for the summer, because the summers there are cold in that country. And then I'd use that suit up to Christmas, and then I'd put on my new suit after Christmas, you see. So I always had good clothes.
When you were fully dressed for winter, did it feel heavy on you?
No, because you were using fawns. You see, your inside was fawns and your outside's adults. It'd be yearling or two-year-old, but very short fur. The hair would only be about an inch long. You see, long hair, your hair would fall out, your short hair. If you get your caribou first part of August, from August the 1st to the 15th of August, that's just right for clothes skins. After that, your hair's too long, you see.
On the outside part, did you use a wolf rug or just a caribou?
No, I used to use Wolverine all the time, because your Wolverine don't match, you see, it don't frost. There's only two skins that are practical for rough, for working in that country, is your polar bear, which is oily, the hair is porous, and your Wolverine. Your wolf mats up, your fox mats up, your caribou mats up. Those are the only two fur that I know that don't mat. That is kind of the oil in the fur and the hollow in each hair, you see. Each hair is hollow through.
What kind of mittens? Caribou mittens?
Well, you could use all kinds. I used to use canvas mitts and fur mitts, and I'd have a whole box full on the sled because you're changing all the time. And storm mitts. When you're setting traps, it takes a lot of mitts because you can't use a big mitt, you see. But when you get finished, then you use a big storm mitt. You just put your other mitts inside of that. And if your hands get cold, well, you just take your mitts off and put them along your belly here, along your skin, you see. That's nice and warm there. See, the heat of your body can't get out of your fur skins. That stays right in the heat of your body, so your heat of the body is nice and warm all the time. But if you were using white clothes, you'd